Hello, I'm David Hunt, CEO and founder of the Hyperion Cleantech Group and your host for the Leading Cleantech Podcast. Now, I hope you've all enjoyed the summer vacation and that you had some time to relax. As you would have noticed, I took some time away from the podcast in July and August. Not all vacation, I assure you. But I do have some great guests lined up all the way up to Christmas, and I hope you continue to support, share, and enjoy the podcast. Particularly as I'm delighted to share that this is our 100th episode. Crazy, I know, for a niche podcast at the intersection of clean technology and business. But listennotes.com says that we're in the top 1.5% of podcasts globally. So thank you to those who subscribe, share and listen. Now on this podcast, we love sharing the stories and founding journeys of pure play clean tech companies. And we'll continue to do so. But increasingly what inspires me most are existing companies in traditional sectors who are being bold and taking big bets and risks to commit to their own transition to clean mobility and energy. This week I'm delighted to be joined by Brendan Keegan, CEO of Merchants Fleet, a company fully committed to the electrification of fleet transport and a leader in diversity in its teams and employees and with a genuine commitment to their sustainability. We need to be helping and encouraging large companies to take the transition seriously, no greenwash, and we should celebrate the pioneers doing so, which we'll do now. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, Brendan. Welcome to the Leaders in Cleantech podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me today, David. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, there's so much to go through, which is a great thing. So in particular, I think for our audience, most of our guests, they'll know, tend to be sort of founders and CEOs of cleantech companies. But what I'm really, really keen to explore with you and generally now is how leaders within large organizations and established industries deal with the disruption that's going on, particularly around mobility and that element of disruption and rapid change, which, as you know, you're going through both externally and internally. So it'd be really good to get your thoughts on that. But before we do that, it's always good to get a little bit of context. So perhaps you can share a little bit of what brought you to, because you've got a very sort of diverse history of leading organizations and businesses in various sort of business services fields, but now you were the logistics and transportation company for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years. So what led you to join Merchants Fleet in the first place?
So my journey to Merchants Fleet is actually quite an interesting one, and I think it's unique in that, you know, I go back to 2009. I was running a technology company, and we happened to have a very large fleet ourselves. It was right after, we kind of got hit with the a little bit of a recession. So we did a very large sale leaseback with Merchants Fleet. So I go back, 13 years ago, and I was Merchants' largest client. So I get to know the company over a number of years. You know, my background not being fleet or auto, my background being technology, financial services. And then, after being a client for a number of years, I joined the board. And I joined the board to really help them more readily move into the technology space as vehicles were having more data on board, as you were looking at technology transformation, they were looking for somebody with more of a technology background. And then what I would tell you is, at some point in time, when you make a lot of suggestions during board meetings that make sense, eventually they're going to turn the tables. And they're going to say, why don't you run the place then? So that's what happened after being on the board for a couple of years and didn't come from the auto space, didn't come from the fleet space. It is the fifth company I've had a chance to run and be CEO of, so I felt comfortable in that realm. But we've really pushed our company, Merchants, more from being a fleet company into being a fleet technology company, which has really differentiated us over the past couple of years.
Yeah, now that's an interesting play, actually, because I can get that data was starting to play a part maybe a number of years ago in terms of the whole logistics and transportation space and running and making it more efficient, the processes. But e-mobility specifically is obviously much more recent. When you joined full-time into the organization those 5, 6 years ago, how much was it on the radar that there was a transition, not just in sort of data of logistics, but actually in actual vehicles and the sort of infrastructure that was involved? Was e-mobility on the horizon for you guys at that time? And at what point, did that start to sort of rear its head?
I'll tell a few stories and don't mean to embarrass anybody, but, when I was bringing up the terms mobility, even to Merchants as a board member, I started getting questions like, Brennan, are you talking about ADA? And I'm like, no, I'm talking about, us looking at transportation as mm-hmm. more of a mobile application than a traditional long-term lease. So I think that the company was probably a little bit behind on some of the trends. Now, some of that was, as a family-owned business up until recently. And as a family-owned business, they were looking for moderate growth every year. And if they got the growth, then they really weren't looking to, go off and kind of slay dragons, if you will.
Okay.
But when you started to put a thesis together and you started to look at, is the auto and fleet industry ripe for disruption? You quickly came out with the thesis that it was. Certain markets are opportunistic for disruption, some aren't. This was generally a little bit of a sleepy industry. There were about 8, maybe 9 companies that could really manage fleet across a global footprint or a national footprint. And generally speaking, the industry was happy with 2-5% growth. So you really had an industry that was ripe for a company to kind of stand up and say, we are willing and we have a vision to be a disruptor. Now, that's the internal side. When you look at the external side of going from ICE vehicles to electrification, the industry is very ripe for disruption. And we're seeing that with new manufacturers, new OEMs coming into play, and giving, they'll be giving the Fords and General Motors over the next couple of years, run for their money.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, actually. I saw a graphic this morning, I can't recall who posted it, around the number of electric semi-trucks coming to the market within the next 2 years. We all know of the Tesla semi, of course, but a number of other OEMs are bringing product to market as well in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, well, if you go back, say, 10, 15 years ago, there really weren't new OEMs coming into the space. You had Tesla, maybe you had DeLorean, geez, there's a name, before that. But, now you've got a whole host. You've got XOS, you've got Rivian, you got Lordstown. I mean, you have a whole new host of OEMs coming into play, and they're all coming. You can argue, are they coming disadvantaged or advantaged? They're coming strictly as electric vehicle companies without any of the, ICE history. So you can say, is that in some ways, that's an advantage where they don't have any legacy to overcome. Now, the flip side is takes intense capital to be able to do that. But I think it's going to be fascinating to watch the OEM depth chart over the next 10 years and kind of see how the industry shakes out and how it shifts.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a few bets myself on who might be the Kodak or two in there, but we'll maybe share that later if we get around to it. To give us some context for the audience, because I'm really keen to dig into the disruption that you're going through, both in terms of markets and internally leading a company through that kind of transition, and then to sort of talk about electrification of fleet more generally in terms of what's going on, how we're addressing this and what can be achieved. But I think it's useful to get some context. So again, can you just share with a little bit how this family business in logistics has evolved and essentially what services and products and solutions you actually provide to the market right now?
Sure. So let me just start by defining fleet in the most simplistic way. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're driving down the road, 1 out of 5 cars that you see on the road is a fleet vehicle. So when you think of fleets, the natural ones that come to mind are, let's say, the U.S. Postal Service or UPS or FedEx or Amazon. Why? Because, they're just so prevalent. Then you could look at, companies that show up and, kill bugs at your house like Terminix. And then you could, as you're pulling into your neighborhood, you might see a landscaping truck there. That's a fleet vehicle. You might see a small local painting company, Joe's Painting and Sons. That's a fleet vehicle. So let's just start with 1 out of 5 vehicles in North America is a fleet vehicle. So we'll start there.
Yeah.
Then once you go down that path, you start to say, okay, what do we do? Well, we manage approximately 170,000 fleet vehicles, generally not for the Joe's Painting of the world, but for, bug companies. I had mentioned Terminix, the large last mile delivery companies.
Right.
We manage 170,000 of those vehicles. And what's key to managing those is technology. So, we have a technology platform where if you have, 5,000 vehicles and they're all over the U.S., they're in Canada, we have every ounce of it. We have every imaginable piece of information about those vehicles, where they are, who's driving. Are there toll violations? Do they need driver roadside assistance? What's the mileage? What's the maintenance? We know everything about that. We know when it should be cycled. And what we do for our clients is you save a tremendous amount of money on a monthly, annual basis on their fleets, but also increase the safety of their drivers. So, right. You know, there's in the U.S., there's nine companies that really do this to scale. And currently we're the fourth largest in the U.S.
Okay.
So that's a little bit about, you know, just maybe framing what fleet is for your audience to think of as they're driving down the road.
Yeah. Yeah, as you say, it's quite a diverse. But one of the things, that, again, you're picking on or talking about a number of industries there, you know, large-scale logistics, last-mile delivery is a huge topic that's come to the fore, particularly, you know, last couple of years with COVID and lockdowns and the sort of prevalence of increase even of these sort of delivery services on the last mile. In terms of the transition towards electrification, it'd be interesting to hear from you how much of that was push and pull in terms of how much were you approaching, you know, these big logistics companies or your clients saying that this is the direction of travel, and how much were they knocking on your door saying, hi, we need to explore this, or is this a thing, or is this even possible?
At this point in time, so, you know, sitting here in mid to late 22, it's more of a push. Mm-hmm. So what we see is a lot of companies coming from the boardroom down, and they're talking about their ESG strategy. They're talking about sustainability. They're talking about corporate citizenship and social responsibility, but that doesn't always work its way to the fleet manager. Now, you also have to recognize that when we approach that fleet manager, you know, it's very daunting for them. You know, right now, if you're a fleet manager and let's just pick, you're running pickups and you got Chevy Silverados and you got Ford F-150s, you know, your job for the last 5-6 years has been very similar. You know, I order a certain number every year, I give my drivers fuel cards, and I've got my maintenance network. All of a sudden, you throw in electrification, and now you've got questions of, well, where are we going to charge them? What's the range? My drivers have range anxiety. Am I going to use the same vehicle in Manhattan that I'm going to use in Wyoming, where the driving application is completely different? Yep. Some of my drivers take them home. How are they going to charge them at home? How are they going to charge us back? How do we split the electric bill between their house, their pool, and their vehicle? And then we have depot centers. Well, is there enough energy grid to bring to my depot center if I've got 30 chargers there? So all of a sudden, the level of complexity for the fleet manager goes up exponentially.
Yep.
And it's no longer 80% about the vehicle. It's 80% about the infrastructure, 20% about the vehicle. And what I'll tell you is with the infrastructure, we are in the early, early stages, very, very early stages, you know, across the U.S. And I know what we do as a company, we take as much of our lessons and our learnings as we can from Europe, also from China and parts of Asia Pacific that are literally years ahead of where we are here in the U.S. at how have they done it, what applications, and what learnings can we take from other countries and other companies that have already been on the journey a little bit further along than the U.S.
Yeah, there's an element of evangelization there, and I get what you're saying. And again, from experience, a number of people who are in the traditional automotive industries, A, they're well embedded to combustion engines because it's what they know and they've always known. And also in business, or, you know, nobody wants to make their life harder or their job harder. And to some extent, like you said, you're bringing a lot of complexity, which we all know is more daunting than it sometimes needs to be. And which is clearly what you're doing is that education piece. And are you finding that once you get conversations with these fleet managers within your client businesses that they can see that this is achievable, or do you still have a lot of pushback and ultimately it's the board driving the decision rather than those who have to actually manage the process?
So we have a 5-step process we walk our clients and prospects through, and one of the first things we try to do is align, you know, their ESG strategy, their EV strategy with the technology adoption lifecycle. And we say, do you want to be an early adopter? Do you want to be an innovator? Do you want to be the early majority, the late majority, a laggard? So kind of using Jeffrey Moore's technology life cycle. So the first thing we do is we say, where do you want to play on that? So you've got some companies that say, hey, We are very socially conscious company. We're in the consumer business. Our consumers are going to demand this. We want to be an early adopter. So then we'll say, okay, well, you have 1,000 unit fleet. Then we want 20% a year for the next 5 years. And in 5 years, you want to be 100% electric. Then we go to another company and they say, you know, we're in rural Kentucky. It's not as important. We're not a consumer company. ESG is important to us, but it's not vital. We'll say, well, you're probably more of a late majority company. So you probably want to go 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%, 25% yeah. over the next 5 years. So the first thing we try to do before we even, give any type of plan is understand where do they want to be positioned from a technology strategy, from an ESG strategy, from an EV strategy, and then back into what is your fleet plan for the next 5 years. Yeah. One of our challenges right now, believe it or not, is when we get those early adopters, is bringing these EVs, the commercial EVs, so think cargo vans, think light duty, medium duty pickups, think box trucks, maybe step vans. So kind of in that transportation and logistics space, right now the demand far outstrips the supply.
Yeah.
Because this is a new technology. This isn't, you know, taking a F-150 or a Chevy Silverado and just pulling the engine out and putting a battery in. It's a completely different build. So, you know, we're a little behind on the timelines, but also we still are fighting the supply chain, even in ICE vehicles. So, you know, the timing right now is a bit challenging.
It is. There are many converging things there, obviously around the sort of manufacturer supply, battery supply chain, all of these things, and like overlaying on that, the chip stuff, which affects any kind of vehicle. So there is a supply squeeze, and that's certainly holding back in Europe. Also, is the demand certainly for electric vehicles outweighs supply. We'll return to that in a second, actually. But what I'm also keen to explore, Brendan, is resistance and disruption internally. So how large an organization in terms of numbers are you, and how have you as a CEO leader brought this message to your team, and what kind of challenges and resistance have you faced internally as you go through this disruptive journey internally?
Yeah, so, you know, we are about $2.5 billion in assets, and, you know, we're a 60-year-old company. We're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year. Now, over the last 4.5, 5 years, the company's gone from being a $500 million company to $2.5 billion. So we've seen just tremendous growth over the last 5 years. Employee-wise, we're about 650 employees. You know, if I go back to 2018 and I really give an honest assessment, we reorganized the company. And this was kind of one of the benefits of me being a former client and being on the board is I did have a vision for as a client, you know, I don't want to understand your business. I don't want to go to different divisions. I want to be served through kind of one person.
Yeah.
So when we reorganized, you know, what I'd tell you is it was a traditional reorganization. You had 20% of people on board excited before you even told them what you were going to do because that's just their personality.
Yeah.
Then you had another 20% that even if they, you know, like reader, they were just going to sit back and just kind of wait. And they were your, you know, your doubters. And by the way, I would say this, if you brought in free pizza for lunch, you'd have 20% of people that would thank you and have 20% of people would say, why didn't you bring in salads or something healthier?
Yeah.
So this is no different. And then you had, you know, the middle, the majority kind of saying, let's see how this plays out. And so that first year was the most challenging where we did reorganize the company. We put all the business units into one business unit. We renamed. We had five different businesses. We renamed everything Merchants Fleet. And it was a tough year. But I think one of the things that if you do want to disrupt an industry, and it starts with creating a business transformation internally, you've got to ask yourself three questions. Are you ready? Are you willing? And are you able? So are you ready? Is your industry ready? Is your company ready? The second thing is, are you willing? Because you're going to have to do things that you don't necessarily want to do. You're going to say a skill set we have in a given department isn't going to be the skill set in that same department we need in a year.
Yep.
So for instance, we have way more people that are data analysts today than we had 4 years ago because we've invested, you know, approximately $50 million a year into technology. And then the third thing you've got to ask yourself is, are you able? Now, are you able? What I find comes down mostly not to, you know, intelligence, experience, or knowledge. It really comes into attitude and will, and just is somebody able to make the move? And you know, in any transformation of anything, you know, whether it's, you know, a company or a sports team, you've usually got 10-20% of people that just aren't able to get there. They aren't able to get there emotionally. They aren't able to get there mentally. And there's a term we use in the company for that, saying fixedness, that, you know, their mental model is, hey, I've been doing it this way for 10 years and this is how I'm going to do it. Or that's not how we do it here. And you've really got to have the fortitude to not tolerate that. Now, and I'm not saying that from a like a tough guy standpoint. I'm saying you just have to say, hey, we know that's how we've done it the last 10 years, but we're going to take a look at maybe there's a better way to do it now. Maybe there's a different way to do it now. And some people just don't make that transition. And, and some of that is just their fixedness. So, So the first year by far in any business transformation, in any disruption, is the hardest year. And I will tell you, there's different nights you're driving home and you're reflecting on the day and you're just kind of saying, did I win today or did I not win today? Because you're trying to do things differently. Now, as you start to get more people on board, you go from 20% on board to 30 to 40 to 50, and you start to have successes. Like in 18, we entered the last mile market. We thought that was going to be a boom. You know, and in 2018, we were super excited when we put 289 units on the road in last mile. And David, if you saw us in the hallway, we were high-fiving. We thought, you know, we just were killing it. Yeah. Well, I'm gonna tell you, at this holiday season, we'll have 27,000 units on the road. And that's 2019 to 2022. So that's not, you know, a big difference. But it really took people believing that that was a market. And then it took people willing to do things that they weren't comfortable doing. And I think when you're able to do that, things are really possible. But, you know, in that disruption, you've really got to make sure one of the most important things after you have the vision for it is, do you have a culture that's going to embrace the transformation?
Right.
And I would say I spent as much time on our culture as our CEO as I did our strategy or our financials. And I'm convinced now with the culture that we've built, the innovationness that we've built, the nimbleness that we've built, and I'll be facetious here, if tomorrow we decided we wanted to sell office furniture, I swear to God, in a year we'd be pretty damn good at selling office furniture. Now, if anyone from Merchants is listening, we are not going in the office furniture business, but I think when you build a culture where people are really willing to try new things and they're really willing to be innovative and they're willing to get outside their comfort zone, you truly open up the opportunities for your company.
Yeah, absolutely. That culture thing, I think, is critical in any business at all times, but in transition particularly so. And it always reminds me of some of the experiences I've had in the past. You know, we used to reference the people on the bus. Have you got the right people on the bus? And sometimes you have to allow some very nice, talented people to get off the bus because for them, it's no longer the bus that they could or should be on. And that sometimes can be a challenge to handle culturally when you're going through these transitions. And I wouldn't ask you to particularly sort of dwell on that. But it's around having that ability to be agile when you're going through a disruption. If your markets are agile externally, you've got to be agile internally too.
Yeah, so, you know, I just want to come back to your bus story because I got an interesting anecdote there. So, you know, it's definitely true. You've got to gently tell some people that, you know, their bus pass is revoked, and that's fine. But what I also find when you go through a transformation, there were certain people that were the most popular kids on the bus that as the company goes through the transformation and you build new businesses, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it's like you just got a new kid into the school and somebody else is more popular. And I found it fascinating one time, this is about 2 years ago, in the middle of the transformation, when one senior leader gave to another senior leader when they were going on vacation, I don't know if you're familiar with the book called The Energy Bus and by John Gordon. And what it talks about is, you know, you've got to just not sit on the bus, but you've got to bring the right energy. And I thought it fascinating because it was one employee saying to another, hey, you used to be one of the stars of the company. You're still incredibly important, but don't bring negative energy onto the bus because your department isn't the shining star anymore. And we've got more shining stars, but sit back and say, you're on the journey, you're on the bus and you're a part of it and be happy with it. And I can tell you that person really turned around. And by the way, they were doing a great job, but you could just see that, again, they went from being, you know, quote unquote, the popular kid to the average kid. But what it was like, be happy for the company being successful. Yeah. Don't focus on the role your team plays. because, you know, as the company's expanded, you know, a lot of people that, you know, used to have 50% of the company's revenue now have 20% of the company's revenue. It doesn't make you any less relevant, but if you don't bring the positive energy, you know, onto the bus each day, it is going to degrade. So maybe a little aside there, but with the bus analogy, I just had to grab John Gordon's book there and talk a little bit about the energy bus.
Yeah, no, absolutely, it's critical. Well, actually, in the podcast page, we'll put a reference to the book so people can hook up and have, take a look at that. It's a it's a good one, as you say. And I think, as you say, it's getting that this is a team sport, and you might be the sort of the star quarterback 1 year. I'm not big on American football, so probably get the analogy slightly wrong. But you know, you can't always be the star of the team, whatever role or position you're in, and that evolves as the team sort of grows and matures, I guess. And certainly that happens within business cultures. There's a lot to talk about fleet, and I'm really keen to get back to electrification side of things.
Yeah. So,
but just one thing that did pick up that often we talk about on the podcast, because it's such a big challenge and a difficulty around building teams and cultures and successful businesses these days, is around diversity and inclusion, and particularly in, you know, tech industries and clean tech industries, which are the automotive industry is particularly sort of male dominated. And again, I know that you've made some good headway from what I've read and seen from in that space. Again, is that something which you've had to work hard at to work on to make sure that sort of the culture is right, but equally it's also an inclusive and a diverse culture?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I'm not sure, you know, if I give credit to, you know, my mom or dad or maybe even my sister on this, but, you know, I've always, in all my roles I've been in, I've always really been probably in diversity and inclusion and equality, you know, most focused on maybe gender equality. And mm-hmm. and you hit this, you know, I grew up in the technology industry, which tends to be, you know, more male than female. You come over to the auto and fleet industry, and it even swings more male than the tech industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I got here, you know, we had a 10-person leadership team, very capable people, but no females, and we didn't have any female VPs in the company. And currently I have 10 direct reports, and I have 5 male and 5 female. So, you know, that fits into our larger ESG strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, 3 have come up internally through the ranks, 2 have come in externally. So on, you know, inclusion, I think we do a very good job. On equity, we do a very good job. You know, on diversity, that's one we're still fighting. I would say we've got not a long road, but a sustained road to go on that one. I will tell you, COVID has actually helped us in that we hire more remote workers now.
Yep.
But, you know, we've also done, you know, a number of other things where right now in our fleet business, we're actually 51% female and 49% male. Which I personally find fascinating for the industry that we're in.
Yeah.
And I think part of that, and I say I think because you don't know, I think having 5 women on the leadership team has wound up becoming more of a magnet for other women to see.
Absolutely.
You know, hey, if I want to be in this industry at Merchants, I have the chance to go all the way up the chain. And I think that's made a big difference. And I say that because, you know, When you know, we hire women, I don't get them coming in my office saying, "Hey, Brendan, I joined because, you know, you support women," right? I will tell you, every conference I'm at, I get stopped minimum 3, 4, 5 times by just random people saying, "Hey, Brendan, you know, I just wanted to thank you for all the visibility you're giving to women in the fleet industry." And so I do think it's consciously out there. I also hear it from clients and prospects. You know, because when we're sitting across from a procurement team on a very large bid, well, that procurement team is diverse. They're looking for inclusion. And by the way, you just can't send a diverse and inclusion team there and think you're going to win. I mean, these companies, you know, they go on LinkedIn, they look at your website, they know your makeup. So it is something that I would say I would give us above average marks on. But, you know, it's sort of like running a marathon. So, you know, we're at mile 8 and we got a good pace, but we still got a long way to go. And, you know, we're only as good as our last mile.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, well, congratulations, Anne. It's very visible and it's a great thing. And I think absolutely it's the case that that people will see that. And it's, you know, knowing from our own point of view in terms of building leadership teams and recruiting, people do look, and it is an attraction. It is a magnet for people from diverse backgrounds when they see that other people from those backgrounds are being successful. So testament to that. But let's get back onto electrification, because this is a piece we touched on already, that so much of the, we've reached a tipping point in so many ways with electrification of transport, with more and more certainly passenger or car EVs on the roads these days, both in the US and more so in Europe. But there are so many challenges with infrastructure we've touched on, and power supply and sort of the ability to charge vehicles. And supply side is challenging. And so the demand is increasing way beyond the pace that even we're able to electrify or create infrastructure, it seems, despite the millions and billions that have been invested to do so with Electrify America and all these other sort of schemes which are going on. Interesting to see from a US perspective what you see are the biggest challenges holding back your clients from making these decisions and to electrifying. And perhaps overlay on that, obviously, the recent sort of Inflation Reduction Act from Biden, see how that. Is that going to make an impact? Is that going to help companies tip this balance? What's the sort of lie of the land at the moment, Brendan?
Yeah, so I think that if you're, let's say you're a fleet manager or you're an operations manager at a U.S.-based company, you know, three challenges that I think we have in the U.S. is, I'll start with our geography. So if you look at many of the countries in Europe that have been successful, they're much denser. They don't have as many rural areas. So when you know, take a look at the U.S. and you have a national fleet, you know, it's a very different solution when you get out to North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Montana, than it is, you know, Philly, Boston, New York, you know, Hartford, Connecticut. Like, let's say when you get up the East Coast, very, very true when you get into the L.A., San Diego area, all of a sudden you get out to, you know, parts of Utah. So our geography innately makes it more challenging in the U.S. than others. So all of a sudden you say, hey, I just can't order, 300 e-transits that have 125-mile range in Wyoming. In North Dakota, they may have to go 200 miles. So I might need a Ford e-transit in New York and Philly, but I might need a BrightDrop EV600 out in Wyoming. So the first thing is, our country's just geography plays one challenge. Yep. The next is, and I'm going to hit on the government theme. When you look at Europe, regulatory legislation and incentives have played a big catalyst to electrification. And you go to certain countries, and I'll take Norway, where they have the incentive, you know, hey, do this and we'll pay you more. They have a disincentive where if you're looking for, in certain cities, for parking for an ICE vehicle, you will have to wait longer to get a resident parking spot versus if it's an EV. Yep. So, you know, there's incentives and disincentives. In the U.S., we have been very late to the game on incentives, very, very late to the game. And then the third aspect of it is the infrastructure. And here's now you start to get into a debate of public versus private. And the answer isn't public versus private. The answer isn't versus, it's an ampersand. The answer is public and private. You know, when you look at transformation, it's when, you know, public and private work together, where public plays a role, private plays a role. And then, you know, oftentimes public can play the role in not just necessarily providing the funding, but providing the incentives, the tax breaks, the various things that make it possible for private to make those investments. So, you know, with the recent government actions, are we coming along? Yes, but it's sort of like, I'll use a sports analogy. It's sort of like showing up in the third quarter and saying, okay, we're going to start playing the game now.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you can't win. Doesn't mean you can't be successful. Doesn't mean you aren't going to have a great third quarter or fourth quarter. It just means, hey, where have you been the last, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years? So, you know, we've got some catch up to do. You know, with that, you know, one great thing, you know, about the U.S. is, you know, when we decide to do something, and we decide, you know, whether it was 1969 to put a person on the moon, or we decide to put in electrification infrastructure, you know, if we as a country make that decision, as the European countries have, as some of the Asian countries have, you know, we will get there, but we are definitely starting behind.
Yeah, I think one of the struggles actually is around and knowing a lot of our clients in the sort of battery storage and the sort of renewables business is understanding the weakness of the US energy infrastructure, in particular the electrical systems, and obviously split into those sort of three different with Norcod and the various other sort of that. And you touched on this already, getting electricity to depots of a high power when you're looking at sort of fast chargers, even megawatt charges, is a challenge anywhere and everywhere, certainly is in Europe. But I guess, you again, the energy and the electricity infrastructure in the US, again, sort of they're codependent. It's very difficult to electrify if you can't put the infrastructure in, and vice versa. So do you see progress being made and an understanding of that potential barrier, both politically and from a client perspective?
Yeah, so I see progress, but what I'd say is not fast enough. Next Monday and Tuesday, I'll actually be in Washington, D.C., in our trade association, and this is going to be the number one topic, the number two topic, and the number three topic, right? Is, you know, how do we as a lobbying group, as an association group, you know, representing fleets from across, you know, all across North America, but in particular in the U.S., how do we really push some of this agenda? And what I'll tell you is people are listening more than they ever have. So that's outstanding. But we're still a little slow to move. Now, when you talk about our energy, let's just talk about our energy grid as a country. I'm not sure a lot of people, because it's not something that, you know, is exciting to listen to. It's not something exciting to read. I don't think a lot of people realize how fragile, and that would be the word I would use, our infrastructure is in the U.S. And by the way, I could talk about our water infrastructure. I could talk about our sewer infrastructure. I could talk about our highway infrastructure. I could talk about our electric infrastructure. But, you know, as a country, our infrastructure, you know, I would say is not where it needs to be as we want to, as a country, go through, you know, a technology transformation and move into electrification.
That's again, is that a challenge because of the sort of less federal, more state orientated play? I've read a number of books, because I am sad that way around, the sort of the growth of the electric from Edison upwards in the US, and how it's kind of all been piecemeal, you know, put together, and it's similar in Europe in many ways. But does this need, and are we seeing a more of a federal play to try and solve these problems, because they are pan-national clearly and not sort of purely at state level?
Yeah, so we will see the government play a bigger role. I think how much bigger is to be determined. You know, generally speaking, in the U.S., we've really pushed it more to privatization than we have public. Now, the other thing that plays a factor in it, and I play a factor in this personally, is we're consumers. You know, when you look at, you know, how much electricity my home uses versus, well, first of all, the size of my home, the size of the average American's home to the average European's home, the average electric consumption of a U.S. city dweller versus, you know, an Asian city dweller. So, you know, when you're consumers, and that's a good and bad thing, you know, about the U.S., you know, consumers keeps the economy going, which is outstanding, but it also consumes. It consumes a lot. So, you know, this is the American dream of, you know, each generation does better than the previous generation. Each generation's house is a little bit bigger than the previous generation's. And ultimately, each generation consumes more than the previous generation. I don't think our infrastructure has kept up with our consumption appetite. That's one part of the equation. And in my opinion, I don't see that changing tremendously. You know, I could just look at, you know, the internet usage in my house this year, 10 years ago, and 20 years ago. You know, 20 years ago, you know, it was very little. 10 years ago, you know, we had a couple devices. Now, you know, everyone in my house has you know, a phone, has an iPad, has a laptop. And on top of that, all our TVs are streaming now. So I just look and say, geez, how much internet, how much electricity am I consuming just on those devices versus what I was using 10 years ago? Now I've got two EVs in my garage. So, you know, I'm sitting here going, geez, you know, what's the electric equation here? And so, you know, it's not just, hey, the infrastructure needs to pour it over for electrification. It's in an increasing demand cycle. And right now, you know, I'm looking really just across the pond over to the UK. And I think we're seeing, you know, electric prices there spike dramatically. And I don't live there, so I'm reading some of it third party, and you know, everyone's putting out different numbers, but every number they're putting out is staggering at the price increases that they're expecting to come, you know, over this next 12-month period.
Yeah, no, it is having an impact on the juice we put in our vehicles, which for a while we were quite smug when petrol prices were high and electricity was low, but that's not necessarily the case right now. So that was another thing I was going to touch on. I mean, there's so much to talk about, and I know that on your website you have some great white papers around some of myth-busting, which, you know, people can go and research and take a look at. But that was one of the things around Plus Point, was that whilst there may be some expense in moving to an electrified fleet, generally the cost of ownership was already less and going more so in that direction. Clearly in Europe, that, as I say, with the price change, that sort of impacts into that. But going back to clients, those who are interested or wanting to go down the path, what are the things that potentially are the barriers? Are they technology in terms of, you know, are they sort of inductive charging, all these other things which are perhaps around the corner? Are they financial? Are they cultural? What are the sort of the barriers which are stopping some of your customers throwing themselves wholeheartedly into the transition?
Yeah, what I'd say is it's not stopping, it's having them question. And I would go to kind of the psychology and culture side of it. You know, we're spending a tremendous amount of time with driver management, with change management, with range anxiety. You know, we have a lot of our clients that they'll talk to us range anxiety. We'll pull up their telematics data and we'll say, your average vehicle drives 18 miles a day. In the areas we're going to put the electric vehicles. So we're not going to go put the electric vehicles in North Dakota. We're putting them in these targeted cities. And we go, 18 miles a day, not a problem. Not a problem, but you can see that, and then you put the driver in it, and the driver's like, what am I going to do, you know, in the middle of the day? And what we actually convince them of is that you're going to charge this every night when you bring it back. So unlike your ICE vehicle, which every day is you are not going to start the day with a full tank of gas.
Yeah.
In your electric vehicle, you're going to start the day every single day with a full tank, and you're never going to have to really gas up, you know. So if you drive by a gas station in the US and you drive by and you see, you know, a UPS van or an Amazon van or some fleet vehicles, if that were an electric vehicle in the future, the drivers aren't going to take 15 minutes out of their day, 10 minutes out of their day to fuel. Yep. They're actually going to be doing that at the end of the day, overnight, or in the morning before they get in it. So, you know, it's cultural. And then even once the company has made the decision, there's typically, remember that 20% of people I said when you order pizza, they say, why didn't you order something healthier?
Yeah.
And by the way, the next week when you order something healthier, the pizza people go, hey, how come you didn't order pizza this week? So you've always got 20%. But you've also then got the 20% of people that, quite frankly, don't want to see this change.
Mm-hmm.
And they just come in culturally and by with no intent, with no ill will, or just question everything. And so what that does, instead of making maybe a smooth transition, it just makes it a little bit bumpy. When that all goes away is when somebody on the client side is a strong leader that kind of says, hey, guys, I hear you. I know I get the range anxiety. I know you've got some questions. You're asking about the grid. You're asking about the infrastructure. But we're doing this and we're moving forward. When there's a strong leader representing the client, I can tell you, all those challenges I just talked about just melt away.
Go away.
Literally melt away.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And I should say, it does take strong leadership, and it does take a cultural shift. Any kind of disruption does. Look, we could talk forever, Brendan. It's been fascinating talking to you. And like I say, we'll point people on via the episode page to the Merchants Fleet website. I know there's some huge, some great data and some great white papers and information there. I always close the podcast with looking at, and you've mentioned one already, because I'm an avid reader and I always look to absorb more, to see if there are any book recommendations that you have, either professional or personal, that have sort of inspired you or that you return to or keep you going in life. You've mentioned one, which was obviously The Energy Bus, which we'll refer to, but
yeah.
Anything else?
There's one book that if you haven't read it, I'd tell every person out there, you've got to listen. You got to listen to it or read it. And a book I read a long time ago, called The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. actually keep one in my office, and I probably give four or five away during the year when I'm just talking to somebody and I grab one. It's a great book. It talks about how do things get past the tipping point. So in that Jeffrey Moore's chasm, how does it go from early adopter to innovator? And how does it jump to early majority? Yeah. Now, there's another book by a gentleman, Jonah Berger, who's a professor at the Wharton School of Business at UPenn, and he writes about contagious. So if you're in a service business, how do you get your business to be contagious? Because, you know, like, for instance, you know, at Merchants, we're never going to run a Super Bowl ad. We're never going to have a blimp. We're never going to have this big advertising budget. But mm-hmm. the best way for us to grow our business is word of mouth, people to hear about us. And he's got a whole book and a whole process on how do you make your business contagious. And I can tell you those two books, I don't think there's a week that goes by that I don't refer to those two books in some way, in some talk with our employees.
Super. No, I appreciate that. Certainly the tipping points on my shelf, the contagious I've heard of, but I'll dive into that. So thanks for sharing that. But listen, Brendan, it's been great to talk to you. And, you know, as I said at the top, it's just so important we have these traditional industries and traditional companies who are making the transition. It's not just all about Silicon Valley startups or Berlin, Amsterdam or London-based startups. It's about everybody going on this journey. And it's great to see what you're achieving with Merchants Fleet. So thanks for sharing some of those stories with us.
All right. Thank you for your time, Dave. And I really appreciate your insights and I enjoy following you. And good luck this week at your panel you're moderating.
Yeah. Flight to San Diego leaves, I think, in about 4 or 5 hours. And it's a fair old jaunt from Europe to San Diego. So plenty of reading time there for sure.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Brendan. Hello, and thanks very much for joining us on the Leading Clean Tech podcast. I hope that you enjoyed that episode and appreciate you joining us again. Please do subscribe if you haven't already, and please do share any episodes of particular interest within your community. If you do get an opportunity to write us a review on Apple Podcasts or your platform of choice, very much appreciated. Hopefully see you on the next episode.